You are listening to Icons and Icons, Final Fantasy XIV Game Club podcast. This is episode 68, covering the story of Final Fantasy XIV's patch 3.1, or the start of all the bullshit between Heavensward and Stormblood. There's a lot of it, even though there's not very many quests. They're all very long. We can't be doing what we did today for Stormblood. I have your host, Chris Taylor. My pronouns are he, him. With me is my esteemed co-host,
Ryan Beatty. My pronouns are they, them.
What happened last time? It'll be fast and easy.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I alighted about half of what we did last episode, and still it's an entire long ass paragraph. So last episode, we finally caught up with Thordin and his Heaven's Ward in Azis-La. After we restored our connection with Hydaelyn, very arbitrarily, we were powerful enough to defeat two Asians. We killed one of them with the eye, and then Thordin showed up, turned into a primal god king, and executed the second one. We can't suffer primal god kings, so we killed the powered up archbishop before he could go full reign of terror on the whole planet. Unfortunately, reuniting Nidhogg's two eyes was too much for Astinian to handle, and Nidhogg took over his mind and transformed him into a shade of the Dread Worm. After we returned to Ishgard on the back of a dragon, Aemerich made an announcement to the people of Ishgard that their entire religion was founded on a lie and that he would be pursuing peace with the dragons. That'll turn out great. We begin this episode with a quest called An Uncertain Future.
I wonder what that's about. Zadaru gives us an update on our search for the missing Scions. Palamon is apparently hiding out in Razit Han, which is definitely the first time that Razit Han has ever been mentioned. Papalimo and Yida's link pearls have been recovered in the business district of Ulda. It's so funny. They're just like, gotta throw this cell phone in the alley. Bye.
Yeah.
They likely ditched them after escaping the Royal Promenade to avoid potential eavesdroppers, which probably Papalimo's idea. Papalimo doesn't believe that Yida could just not accidentally turn her cell phone on.
Yeah, well, and he's got, you know, he's got experience to show he might be right, even though Papalimo sucks and Yida rules.
Look, might be true, but also fuck Papalimo.
That's right.
There's been no news about Thancred and Minfilia, but we're getting one of the students of Valdessian to help us soon. The idea of another nerd excites Alphanode. For now, though, Alphanode received an urgent summons for us to go see Sir Aemerich. According to Ishgard's rules, the Lord Commander has temporarily assumed his dead dad Thordren's position as the Pope. He feels pretty uncomfortable about it, since he did just announce that their entire religion was founded on a lie. Did he announce this, or was he about to?
No, he did. He, okay. Because of the limited ability to show, you know, multiple models on screen, because the PS3 was still a consideration.
Is that what's up with those five guys? Is that supposed to be the whole country?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah. Love that. It takes the nation of a dozen to hold us back.
So it seems that the people did not take this news as well as Aemerich had hoped. There are still lots of true believers, and even those who agree that Thordin had to be stopped are questioning everybody's methods and suspect that secretly it might have been a coup and not like a righteous execution. As a result, violence has erupted in the streets. Clergy are being harassed in the streets and assaulted in the broom. Hilda and her hounds are helping the Temple Knights maintain order, but the unrest will continue to spread unless we can do something about it. And at this point, I was like, gee, if only we had like someone who could bridge the gaps of the different sides and push for peace like Isael. And real shame that the plot decided to kill her. And then Aemerich basically says the same thing. So I was like, OK, well, the game's acknowledging it, but still doesn't make it a good story choice.
I don't know why they think that. Like, the problem is the ultra conservative religious elements. They're like, yeah, you know who would be great at reaching out to those people? Our friend the heretic.
That's you're totally right about that. But right now, they think they don't know who it could be, even though everybody
knows.
You know who we need to
send to like APAC to de-radicalize the conservatives? AOC. That's what this is.
Very cursed to think of Isael as the AOC of Final Fantasy XIV.
I'm extremely ineffectual and fucking huffing her own shit. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So to solve all of this, Aemerich wants to finally bring the Dragonsong War to a definitive end. He and Lucia want our help to introduce them to the Dragons of Anix Trine for a parley. After we agree to it, we get another particularly long Edmont excerpt here.
In the wake of the Archbishop's fall, the nation of Ishgard trembled and the faith of her people shaken to its very core. For 1,000 years had they fought and died, certain of the justice of their cause, only to be told that their holy war was born of the sins of their forefathers. What then for those brave men and women thus stripped of their righteousness but to despair? To deny the truth and decry its speakers? And what then for those whom they defame but to hope on, to have faith in a bright tomorrow, a tomorrow in which man and dragon might live in harmony, then as distant as the very stars in the heavens? That's right, go back to space. Yet while we dared hope, deep within his lair, the enemy lay gathering his strength. Nidhogg, now possessed of his two eyes and the body of the Azure Dragoon, prizes to which he had laid claim at the very hour of the hero's triumph. As desperately as we sought the solace of peace, the great worm craved the misery of war. Nor was he alone in this misbegotten desire, Ellipsis.
So, Lucia knows almost nothing about Anix Trine and would be more nervous about the journey if she didn't have such wonderful and powerful escorts.
Can't wait to go here on a road trip for the third time.
You know, I like half considered really role playing and not just teleporting to Tailfeather and instead flying through.
Absolute sicko.
Yeah, I didn't, but I thought about it.
No, you know what? That's really, if you were going to fly, that's not really the way the developer intended you to experience this. You should either walk or take a Choco Porter.
Yeah. God damn it. You're right. Well, I didn't do that. I did teleport. So we agree to meet Lucia at the front gates of Ishgard, and then we go tell Tataru what's up and where we're going. She says that if our meeting with Vidofnir ends early, we should stop by Idleshire and meet up with Ishtola, who will be receiving our new Baldessian student ally. She knows that our meeting with the dragons is important at all, but she really, really wants us to meet this new Charlay in person.
God, it's so funny how Alphanode's like, fuck whoever this is, I got stuff to do.
Yeah, fucking being a little lord till the end.
I love that. It's so good compared to who it is.
Yeah.
We travel through the western highlands and into Dravania, stopping at Tailfeather to rest and resupply. Lucia is feeling strange about it. She always thought that the first time she set foot on Dravanian soil would be at the head of an army. Now she's here to treat with the brothers and sisters of her enemies. She reminisces about Lady Iceheart. While Lucia was one of the first to propose allying with her, she continued to have misgivings about joining up with a terrorist who has the blood of innocence on her hands, unlike all of those other terrorists. Alphanode points out that Ysael acknowledged her misdeeds and joined us to fight for the greater good. He hopes that one day she will be seen not just as a heretic, but also as a misguided soul who dreamt of peace. Lucia says that's asking a lot, but she could see it happening. These negotiations are fruitful.
This is just the most liberal eulogy for a freedom fighter I think I've ever heard. Just like, one day I hope that she will be seen not just as a horrific terrorist, but also as a misguided soul who fought for peace is very, I mean, like, it's true. Ysael's like attacks had victims that had nothing to do with the lies of the Dragonsong War, sure, but I hated reading this. I hated it so much. It really made me so mad to be like, one day I hope her legacy is one of the person who found the third way.
Look, she's just like MBS, a misguided freedom fighter.
Jesus Christ. Oh my god.
I can get away with that because not everyone knows what MBS stands for.
Uh-huh. Multi-level marketing scheme. Anyway.
That's right!
Inside Anix Trine's ruined tower, Vidofnir welcomes us, but eyes Lucia with skepticism. We formally introduce them to each other, and Lucia makes her pitch. To Ishgard's shame, they mistakenly believed the dragons to be the architects of the Thousand-Year War, but now she and her people know the truth of ancient Ishgard's betrayal of Ratatoskr. The people are slow to come around, since a millennium-long lie is very tough to break away from. She humbly asks for Vidofnir's hand in friendship to finally achieve the dream of peace. Vidofnir is surprised by this, but can't give an answer until she consults with Freys Velger. Furthermore, the Nath are still harassing the dragons of Anix Trine, and Vidofnir will not abandon her people to the swarm. Lucia is fine with waiting, and Vidofnir jokes that she will receive her answer within her lifetime. Don't worry. Alphanode and Lucia both think the meeting went surprisingly well, but in order to really juice the numbers, Lucia wants to meet with some of the other dragons who live around here. She doesn't think she'll need our protection anymore, so we head off to Idleshire like Tataru wanted.
Now, we're supposed to get to Idleshire to see all these blue quests and camp out for a while doing side content, but fuck that. There are too many. Instead, we make a beeline for Yshtola, who tells us that our new Baldessian ally is out exploring the hinterlands. We meet this mysterious scholar at the bridge into the city, and it's Kryl. She's a Lalafell who wears a robe with Moogle ears and is a callback to one of Final Fantasy V's main characters. She apologizes for keeping us waiting, and Alphanode seems a little stunned to see her. Kryl makes a joke about Alphanode's height, and Alphanode kind of just stammers out that she helped him out while they were both students back in Old Sharlayan. She continues to relish embarrassing him, calling him an 11-year-old child prodigy that had no social graces. Wow, times really changed. But before she can get to the really juicy stuff, he cuts her off and reminds everyone that we have pressing matters at hand. Kryl has a new approach to finding our missing comrade. She believes she can find and follow the trail that teleportation magic usually leaves. When Alphanode asks, why haven't you started already, she admits that her powers aren't quite enough, and that she's hoping to borrow Matoya's crystal eye.
Kryl is very funnily fooled by Matoya's fake wall, just like we were. She's like, I thought we were gonna go to a cave, but I don't see the cave. What's going on here? Everybody has a slight chuckle at her expense. Yshtola then warns everyone that the crystal eye is one of Matoya's most precious possessions, and that she won't likely let us touch it unless we convince her that it is vital. Matoya is her usually sassy, grumpy grandma self as we walk in, talking about Yshtola's, like, she's like, oh, I smell trouble. Oh, it's just Yshtola and shit like that. Kryl formally introduces herself. Matoya knows the founder of the Students of Baldessian and calls him a, quote, old coot. Kryl's face darkens as she tells Matoya, who has been a shut-in for years and has been cut off from current events, that the Isle of Val was obliterated in a magic disaster, and that she was only able to escape thanks to the blessing of light. So the only two people who seem to have escaped the Isle of Val right now are Kryl and Graha Tia. Alphanode is shocked to learn that Kryl possesses the Echo. Kryl replies that nearly all of the students of Baldessian did, and it was through their research of their Echo powers that they intended to learn more about Hydaelyn herself. Through that research, she befriended Minfilia and realized that the two of them have a lot in common.
Immediately makes me dislike Kryl a lot.
the friend of my enemy is my enemy.
That's right. Matoya is impatient to hear why we're even bothering her in the first place, and Kryl lays out her pit. She cannot change the fact that students of Baldessian and the Isle of Val have been annihilated, but the Scions can be restored and Minfilia can still be found. Matoya's crystal eye is actually an ancient crystal of light. Hooray! And Kryl believes she can use it to focus her abilities and locate one of the missing Scions. Matoya grumbles that she was hoping we were calling on her for her years of experience, but sighs, fetches the crystal. Kryl gives us a history lesson. On the cusp of each humble calamity, souls blessed with the Echo always appear. To aid her chosen warriors, Hydaelyn gives each of them a sliver of her strength in the form of a crystal of light. But as her strength wanes, so does the power of each new crystal she creates. Toya's crystal is from a really long time ago, when Hydaelyn was closer to her full strength, so it's way more powerful than most others still around.
So, I think that the Crystals of Light might be the shallowest Final Fantasy Legacy callback in the whole game, because it's like this very powerful legendary MacGuffin here, and then it's not really explored at all. And like, we didn't really get like a physical shard of a crystal of light ever, even though we're supposed to be like one of Heidelin's most powerful champions and all of that. So it's just like, ooh, look at this crystal ball. It's extremely powerful. And then we don't hear shit about crystals of light for the rest of the game, really.
You might call it shallow, but have you considered that all of those 40-year-old people who do nothing but complain about modern JRPGs, that's all they need is there to be a crystal there. Yeah. That's all they want. Classic Final Fantasy. Where are the crystals at, bro?
God, this is this.
I'm thinking of a very specific person, and you know who it is.
I do. I do know who it is.
But there are a lot of these people. They suck.
Yeah, this here is why Heavensward was finally considered the first time that Final Fantasy 14 felt like a true JRPG, is this fucking shitty crystal of light.
Well, that's what was wrong with A Realm Reborn. There were 8 crystals. There's only supposed to be 4.
God damn it. So I was talking with Dave of Tales from the Backlog podcast the other day, and he was complaining about a different JRPG whose plot totally stalled out and started to have a totally unearned escalation that killed the pacing and caused the game to last for another 10 to 15 hours, even though...
Wow, is that Final Fantasy 10?
No, it...
Because that's what happens when you get the airship after you kill Cid. Here's another 10 hours of fucking around. Uh-huh.
No, he was actually talking about Sea of Stars, but I was thinking about it. I was like, oh, maybe this is why people started to call Heavensward a real Final Fantasy, because it does the pacing killing unnecessary escalation at the very end that causes another 15 hours to be tacked on.
Yeah, look, it's what the people want. The people say they don't want what they don't. It's not that they don't want a Zero Myth. They actually do, but they want it there so they can complain about
it. Yeah. Yeah, people just want to be miserable. So, Matoya warns us that using such a power is dangerous. Kryle assures us that her unique echo powers will probably help her. Her power is the ability to talk to any sapient creature by listening to the whispers of their souls. She believes that she can use this to listen to the same elementals that guided us to Ishtola and follow the etheric trail where the elementals kind of stopped looking. She asks Matoya for her permission to use the crystal eye. As long as she doesn't drop it or take it out of her sight, Matoya agrees. Kryle raises a glowing hand to the blue crystal that sits on a little cushion in front of her. Kryle announces that the elemental's trail ends at the foot of Mount Somal. She thinks that Thancred was dropped there and is pretty sure that he didn't get just straight teleported into the rock itself. Fingers crossed. Tailfeather is also at the foot of Mount Somal, so Alphanode endeavors to travel back there and ask the resident Chocobo hunters about it, and oh my goodness, it is just so convenient that we get to go back to Tailfeather, where all the rest of the plot is happening this episode, or this part of the episode.
I love how the plot here hinges on how the native people of the Twelveswood were really lazy and underutilizing the land, so we came in and took it over. And here's proof. They couldn't even bother to fucking finish up the job. They didn't deserve the Twelveswood. Too lazy.
Gross. Gross.
That's really what it is these ancient gods. No, they got tired.
It is. It is. It absolutely is. The ancient guys are just like, I can't be asked to keep looking. Fucking do it yourself.
I gotta keep underdeveloping this, basically, what used to be a wasteland before the religious freaks showed up. In the forests of the Dravanian hinterlands, man, if only there weren't 7 zones named the Dravanian blank.
Yeah.
Ryle reminisces that the Val used to have forests like this, and she and her grandfather used to take walks together in them, but now they all look like the Spencer Mansion after the end of Resident Evil. He took her in as an orphan, raised her, and gave her his family name, so it was the least she could do for him. Ishtola recalls that Thancred had been wounded when she last saw him, and that he might not have approached strangers of unknown allegiance. Still, the hunters in this forest are good enough at tracking that they might have stumbled onto his trail. Alphanode, of course, has already drawn a few sketches of Thancred to help us question the locals. After we split up, Kryle spills that he learned how to draw to impress the ladies.
There is the item description for Alphanode's sketch of Thancred. It says, a surprisingly accurate description of the missing Thancred, suggesting that Alphanode may have mistaken his life's calling.
Draw me like one of your Ishgardian girls.
One of the villagers might have spotted him wielding an axe out by the river beyond the forest and clocked him as something other than a hunter since he wasn't really covering his tracks. At this point, I was like, axe? How twisted did Thancred get in the live stream? Because his whole deal is like throwing knives generally. The chief of Tailfeather has not seen him firsthand, but recently heard a story about a Huron vagabond who slayed a Bandersnatch by himself with style. We all reconvene outside the Vath tribe outpost. Alphanode and Ishtola also heard many reports of someone resembling Thancred out in the wilds. Kryl spoke to a Vath trader who was seeking clothes for a man of refinement, which is different from the usual Vath trader requests. Ishtola wonders why Thancred wouldn't just head to Tailfeather himself, and Alphanode points out that Ishtola did emerge from the livestream totally nude. Ishtola calls him out for being creepy. She's like, oh, you remember how naked I was, do you? Really? And he's like, no, I was just happy to see you. I swear, I was just saying.
The reason she does this, this happens, is he describes it as a moment I will never forget.
Yeah.
Stored that one in the bank for later.
God, Alphanode. The most 16-year-old shit, though. Like, that, okay. Anyway, he's like, no, I'm just saying that Thancred also might have been naked himself, and so he might have been afraid to, like, stroll into an outpost totally nude.
Look, it's fine. You're 16 and you saw your hot older lady friend naked. Whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, just don't tell the lady how excited you were to see it.
Yeah. We go into Lost Astanath to talk to the Vath ourselves. What a sentence. And see if Thancred is hiding out there. The storyteller confirms that he has been staying there in exchange for hides and meat from his hunts, and that he's become a great friend to the Vath. Unfortunately, he just left for Lost Astanath because he heard that the One Mind had summoned Ravana again. This scares the Scions, who doubt he can handle the Primal by himself. We thank the storyteller for the information and rush off to our long-lost friend's aid. This is where I got really fucking mad, because you got the same description that you got last time, which is like, you know, go to this place and slay everyone who's in your way. And this time it turns out there's no one in your way and you could just fly right there. But it's yeah. Worded like, have fun walking on this road and fighting 70 guys.
Well, it's really like demoralizing, because they have you fight like one set of guys at the very entrance, and it's like, oh god, is this going to be another gauntlet that just repeats the exact same thing again? And then it's just one set of guys.
Joke's on them. I'm not level 52 anymore, so now they don't do 50,000 damage to me.
Yeah,
god, they did so much damage.
Yeah.
Alphanode fears the worst when we hear a thunderous rumbling from deep inside the Nath fortress, but when we run towards the noise, we find the man that Elidibus called the Warrior of Darkness on the Moon. And he has an adventuring party at his side. The Lalafell has like the worst fucking haircut you've ever seen. Together, they are beating down Ravana handily. Cannot believe, by the way, here, that they kill Ravana with a tank LB. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, he's so stunned by the power of invincibility that he just collapses to his knees and dies.
2.7 seconds of invincibility, what will I ever do?
Our party runs towards their party like it's the shitty scene in Avengers Civil War, and when the two meet, we get an echo flash. Square Enix decides to illustrate the passage backwards in time by removing the Warrior of Darkness's soul patch. He is leaving.
No.
Yeah. He has a little chin beard, and then his chin beard goes away to be like, this happened a while ago.
Amazing. Amazing. Didn't even notice.
It's amazing. I hate that this guy has not been named yet, so I just keep having to call him the Warrior of Darkness, but that will be resolved.
Brent. It's fine.
Yeah. Okay. Brent.
Don't say that. They just think there's a guy named Brent. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. No. It's fine. It's fine. The Warrior of Darkness is in the flashback, is heaving with his axe drawn and his party huddled up behind him. He declares that they will reclaim the reins of history and rid themselves of the Ascians forever. they have an Ascian cornered and on his knees. That Ascian bellows that they are all fools and that killing him won't save their world. The warrior counters, "We'll see about that." "Well, you won't." And then the party's weapons glow brightly and they all charge him.
I love that these guys just escape from Final Fantasy XII, basically.
I like the Warriors of Darkness shit in this cycle. It's cool. It's good. We come to, and the warrior also appears affected by our flash. He realizes that we are the esteemed Warrior of Light, and he mocks us a little bit for showing up late as though we've lost a step. Nishola warns us that the Aether moves strangely around him, because her role in the plot for a little while is just to give us an update on what the Aether looks like.
Acknowledging that we have a common enemy, Elphinode asks for their names. The warrior looks back at his party slyly, and the archer unleashes a barrage of arrows into the sky, also doing an LB. And Yestrola rushes forward and does the little white mage shield dome, which is cool. Need more combat skills in the plot.
Mm-hmm.
I think they don't do this because they've suddenly become a big fan of removing all of the combat skills they could put in the plot. You're like, wow, what's that? Can't wait till I learn that.
It's like, oh, yeah, we took it out in patch 2.4.
Sorry. A full-on battle erupts between the Scions and the Party of Darkness as the warrior's allies face off against Kryl, Alphanode, and Yestrola. The warrior grins and runs towards us with his axe dragging along the ground for an uppercut strike, and we shake off our daze from the echo just in time and block his attack. Well, we were going to, but a pair of shurikens strike the ground at the warrior's feet, and the reason this happens is because they would not have to do a lot of different animations for how this attack is blocked. He looks up, and he finds Thancred in the worst outfit you've ever seen, perched atop a thick robe and glaring down at him, now sporting a bandage over one eye to show the audience, wow, he's had some tough shit. The two have a very fierce anime battle that climaxes with a mid-air weapon clash that creates the orb of energy exploding. We all love it. Everyone claps. Mm-hmm. They both fly backwards. Finally, the party relents, and the warriors say that it was a bit rude of Thancred to interrupt. Look, this is my least favorite incarnation of Thancred. The voice is not there yet. It's an awkward middle ground for this voice. The outfit is bad. Thancred is eventually extremely cool, but this ain't it, Chief.
Yeah, no. Punished Thancred is not the way.
We can't have an episode called Punished Thancred. We already had one called Punished Elphinode. Sorry.
I know. He has a fucking eye. He has an eye patch, though.
is that what makes someone punish?
In Metal Gear Solid, it does.
I was gonna say, like, what's that fucking guy from Texas?
Oh, wait, Dan something? The congressman?
Yeah.
Punished Dan.
That's right.
You said as much when you were like, we all love it, everyone claps, but this anime battle is very sickly choreographed and shot. I really enjoyed it.
You wouldn't be playing Final Fantasy XIV if you weren't the fucking mark for this. They know what the score is. It's cool.
Wow, cool anime battle absolutely works on me sometimes. So the warrior names his group the Warriors of Darkness as a counter to the Warrior of Light and tells us to remember their faces, for we shall all meet again. We look on as they teleport away. Kryl, who apparently also saw the Echo Flash, finds the name a bit silly. She's like, Warriors of Darkness? Really? Eyepatch Thancred finally looks in our direction and smiles just a little.
So she finds out what we're called.
We all flock to him, but he tells us that catching up can wait until we're clear of the Nath, who have started hissing in rage. We run out of the stronghold. Once we're at a safe distance, Yestrola and Thancred start arguing about who between them is more melodramatic, but then he finally thanks her for teleporting him away and saving his life. We all have a bit of a laugh. So the voice isn't here yet. I'm not really a huge fan of this incarnation of Thancred, but the voice actor change is less jarring because we have not heard Thancred's voice in an entire patch cycle, you know, an entire expansion at this point, because he has been nowhere since before the dawn. You know, that's nice. But yeah, Thancred's voice actor will get much better than this soon.
Hey, look, Thancred's been somewhere and it's been at the picket lines during the voice actor strike.
Word up.
Did that happen here? It might have, actually. As he teases Yestrola for not warning him he would come out of the live stream naked, a series of amazing sepia tone shots of a squirrel covering up his junk flash on screen. Incredible. So glad this is here.
Yeah.
He confirms for us that he was the guy who had been seen hunting and living with the Vath, eventually replacing his animal skins with garments, better becoming a man of refinement. The Vath taught him about Ravana and about when we slew the bug god. Ishola deduces his reason for lurking around the Nath. If he tracked a primal's movements, he would likely come into contact with the Scions again. We discuss our encounter with the Warriors of Darkness. Alphado theorizes that if they can fight Cassians and primals, they must have some sort of magical protection like the Echo. They call themselves the Warriors of Darkness, which make them sound like they're in opposition to Heidelin and the Warriors of Light. We all have a think on that theory. Thankrid tells us not to worry about his bandages because chicks dig scars, and now people might believe that he's heroic when he tells them so. Kryl seems shaken by the Echo Flash still. The warrior knew us, and she wonders if he walked inside our memory the same way we walked in his. But Thankrid's going to be too powerful because he already always had two ladies.
Yeah. It's so funny that he's just like such a horn dog, and also like his other main trait is his like protective older brother complex. It makes sense, but
older brothers have needs too. Okay.
Not touching that one. Not touching that one. Alphanode in the next quest continues to be confused about the Warriors of Darkness. They claim their goals are opposed to ours, but they're taking down primals with echo power, which is exactly what we do and who we are. Furthermore, it's strange that we've never even heard of, much less tried to recruit, such powerful individuals before now. Ishtola agrees. One of the Scion's primary jobs has been to find and recruit people like us, which is how Thankrid found us in the first place. Thankrid has been around enough primal killers to deduce that Ravana was not the Warriors of Darkness' first rodeo. For now, it's time to put these quandaries aside. Alphanode suggests that we go let Vidofnir know that Ravana has been slain. If the Nath are no longer harassing the dragons, it might warm them up even more to Aemerich and Lucia's peace proposal.
Ryle takes that as her cue to leave and asks Matoya for help in tracking down Minfilia. The news that Minfilia is missing shocks and dismays Thankrid, who has bad taste. We assume that she escaped with us. His big brother feelings towards her didn't end just because she's the emissary of Heidelin now. We give Vidofnir the good news about the Nath, and in turn, she gives us news from Hrace Belger. Watching Ysail follow her heart and have faith in her convictions softened his thousand-year rage and reminded him of the commonalities between man and dragon. Hrace Belger entrusted the decision about the proposed treaty to the dragons of Annex Trine, and they have chosen to honor it. Vidofnir herself will journey to Ishgard on behalf of her people. Before we return to Ishgard to deliver the good news, Alphanode closes his eyes and wishes Ysail were around to see this day. Random thought. Imagine how long a dragon's podcast is. Like the Dravani and Melisandre ebook is longer than your human's natural life.
there's that monastery with like an automatic programmable organ somewhere in Europe that's doing the John Cage composition called As Slow as Possible, and it's like supposed to last for like 200 or 300 years. That would be a dragon podcast.
Yeah. God,
fucking Noah Caldwell Gervais is a dragon just talking about the Fallout series for like 45 hours. Great. We cut to a scene back in Ishgard. It is pouring down rain in the usually snowy city, and Aemerich is making the rounds through the room with his royal guard. The camera cuts to a shady individual lying in wait, then bumping into the Lord Commander accidentally. Aemerich doubles over, staring at the knife suddenly sticking out of his gut. As the grimy individual pretends to look shocked, Aemerich collapses onto the wet cobblestones. The cutscene blocking here is very funny because the game can't really make it look like the knife found like a hole in Aemerich's armor. So instead, it looks like this like dinky knife just went straight through solid plate mail.
Yeah, it fucking owned my guy.
Yeah, it's very goofy.
Also, the facial expression on the guy is like, oh, no, did I do that?
Yeah.
Very concerned that Emmerich, it looks concerned that Emmerich has been stabbed, not like I did it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's extremely goofy for what's supposed to be a very dramatic moment. Over the scene of the assassination attempt, Edmont narrates once again. He says, "Even as the Scion celebrated the return of a long-lost friend, honorable men plotted to deprive them of another. Honorable men to whom Sir Emmerich was no hero but a scheming patricide. Honorable men who would fain wash the paving stones of foundation with the tyrant's blood. Honorable men whose knife in the dark was the spark which set the city aflame, and who sang as it burned."
Back in Ishgard, Thancred is still having trouble keeping up with everything we've dealt with in his absence. You and me both, buddy. And he worries that the Scion's troubles will never end. Like, that's what the song says, Thancred, keep up. Ishtola assures him that we will find the rest of our allies just as she and Thancred themselves were found. Lucia and Hilda are together in the Knights' Congregation. They are glad to see us, but have terrible news. Emmerich has been stabbed. He will survive, but had Lord Edmont and Lord Artoriel not been accompanying him, the assassin surely would have succeeded. Soon after the stabbing, buildings all around the city of all allegiances started to burst into flame. The hounds have been putting out the fires as fast as they can, but it seems that more keeps springing up. Casualties are mounting, and the broom was hit the hardest of all the district. Lucia asks for help rounding up the assassin's conspirators, since she's positive this was a coordinated attack. Hilda explains that class differences continue to rear their head. It's true that upper-class buildings were also hit to pillage, but the broom doesn't have the same resources and the crowded buildings are acting like a tinderbox.
Burns, Lucia commands us to hurry up with our investigation. Witnesses must be found and suspects must be identified. We all split up and Thancred joins us and Hilda in investigating the pillars. Thancred immediately tries to put the moves on Hilda and she goes, "Gross, another old noble. I was hoping you would be a ruffian like me." Thancred is like, I can handle being rejected, but she called me old. How dare she?
He's like, "Gruff, I get a gruff is fine."
Yeah.
Thank you, Han Solo.
Thancred's first idea is to find the local gossip, who we know is young Amanelaine de Fortomp. We find him in the jeweled crozier, posing and laying about. Upon hearing about our investigation, he suggests checking out the vault, which Emmerich has opened up to house refugees of the recent fires. He's also like, "And maybe I could chat up some of the sexier refugees if you don't mind." And we're all like, "No, gross. Don't do that. This is a serious investigation." And he's like, "Fine, fine."
Just like the Superdome, they were all just S'ing and F'ing in there. However, when Hilda glares at him, he takes it back and decides to stay put. Thancred is hoping for some one-on-one time with Hilda and suggests the two of them go investigate the sites of the fires, which he agrees to because she thinks if he goes off alone, he'll be robbed and stripped naked again. By the way, did we talk about... Oh, we missed it. Thancred had the most amazing line when we went to talk to Amanelaine. He's like, "What if instead of questioning everyone and poking around in the ashes, we instead ask somebody who might just know? And then the person we pick is Amanelaine." We are so stupid.
Amanelaine's poor little like servant attendant Honoroit is like, if we talk to her, she's like, or him, I don't remember what gender Honoroit is. I'm sorry, but
Honoroit's a man.
Okay, yeah. When we talk to him, he's like, "I really thought that Amanelaine that the young master had turned over a new leaf, but recently he's just like gone back to being a lazy guy who only wants to gossip and hit on women. I'm so depressed."
And then he's like, "I was just kidding. I swear I'm only interested in that one lady who hates my guts up in Camp Cloudtop."
Yeah.
God, yeah, you can tell Hannah writes a man because A, it's a manservant, and B, imagine the dynamic that they would write if she wasn't and she was hanging out with a Manelay.
God, yeah, you're right.
The refugees are grateful for the church's generosity in this trying time, but no one really caught the details of the arsonist. Thancred and Hilda have had slightly better luck. The fires that burned the commoners' homes were destructive and efficient, while those that targeted the nobles and the clergy were clumsy and ineffective. While there's no proof, it does suggest a false flag or cover-up operation. We rendezvous with Alphanode, Tataru, and Yestrola down in the brew. Alphanode has just tackled a suspicious figure to interrogate him. The captive suspect shouts that we have the wrong guy, but Thancred kneels down and notices an oily stench and burns on his hand. Look, he's hard times down at the arson factory. The guy continues to swear that he's a victim. Thancred does the lying cop thing and tells him that his noble patron already ratted him out and has even asked us to put him down like the mongrel dog he is.
This gets the suspect talking as he spills his guts that his noble patron was the one who told him to keep going. He confesses that a clergyman came to him and told him that even a sinner such as himself could find salvation in the Fury's work. He had tried to leave his arsonist past behind, but the holy man told him to set fires again, but this time for God. Hilda takes the man to the congregation and promises to rough him up along the way. By the way, I hate what they did to Hilda, who was a, like, guerrilla freedom fighter who was bullying and harassing the nobles so that the broom could finally get a crumb of rights and that, like bastards, you know, like half noble bastards could finally be recognized as people. And then she just turns into a cop for the status quo immediately once she's fully and formally introduced into the plot.
I got some bad news for you. Technically, this entire expansion is about a successful revolution where the religious order is overthrown and a republic is instilled. And the cops have been destroyed, and this is community-oriented policing. This is what you want. It just also sucks.
Yeah, it really, it's, I know I use liberal as, like, a dismissive slur when talking about this game's politics a lot, and I don't want it to just be, like, easy, lazy shorthand that I throw out to dunk on the game, but the way they handle this revolution, it's they cannot escape this ideology at all, even when they're trying to tell a story about actual radicals, and it is frustrating beyond belief.
Well, that's because it's not framed as revolutionary. It's framed as the natural result of, oh, this was untrue. As a result, we automatically dismantle it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, so this is less about Final Fantasy XIV in general, but I think the conclusion is ultimately correct, that mm-hmm. the goal of the end result of a successful revolution will not be a magical anarcho commune, right? It will be a slightly more liberal set of very similar institutions. Right? That's what community policing is. It's still the police. You just know right. who they are and they live next door.
Right. But the game doesn't frame it as like a frustrating compromise or as like, well, it's not perfect, but it's a step towards progress. Instead, it's treated like the best outcome in a lot of ways. It gets under my skin. I think you're right. I do think you're right, but I think that maybe Final Fantasy XIV stumbled onto that conclusion more than they were like really going for making a point here. And you know
what I think bothers you about it is that the framing of how we get here is the long, slow moral arc of history, and we just happen to be there right at the pivot.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of it. I think you're right. So when Tataru marvels at Thancred's interrogation technique, Thancred tells her that he has seen the suspect's kind before. A troubled soul manipulated by men of power and wielded as a weapon. See, this is good. Thancred, good point. He doesn't know what would have happened if the man had called his bluff, but thinks hypotheticals are for losers.
That's right.
Before we return to the congregation to discuss next steps, Tataru asks Thancred what happened to the outfit she made him, and he had to explain that the livestream ate it. Back inside the congregation, Lucia thanks us and promises that her knights will do some extraordinary rendition on the suspect to get him to confess everything. Artuariel, Edmont's older son, arrives to bring his dad a salve to treat Aymeric's wounds. When Alphanode notices that he seemed a little off, Lucia is like, of course he is. His dad is now widely slandered, and his half-brother just died.
Lucia knows our work is far from over. There are plenty of suspects among the upper classes who might want to preserve the status quo. Aymeric emerges from his chambers to join us in the planning session, and everyone makes a big deal about, you've been stabbed. Are you sure you can stand up and just talk for a little bit? He redirects and reminds us that the men we're looking for would rather set their own city on fire than see it change. They might react unpredictably when they learn we've captured the arsonist. Odd Q, a temple knight, bursts in and informs Aymeric that an armed mob has seized control of the vault, taken the refugees hostage, and barricaded themselves inside. They call themselves the Brothers of the True Faith and are demanding to select the next archbishop immediately. They have also declared Aymeric guilty of patricide, true, and high treason, also true, and must surrender himself to receive Halone's judgment. Lucia finds these demands ridiculous. The truth won't die with Aymeric's execution. It's already out in the world. Artuariel observes darkly that the fundamentalists rage against the passing of the old ways and refuse to accept that there can be no going back.
Edmont suggests that we cannot give in to the brothers' extreme demands and thinks that we may need to go rescue the hostages by force. Aymeric agrees and commands Lucia to establish a perimeter outside the vault's entrance. He asks Hilda to keep the people of the Broom under control. If the families of the hostages decide to take matters into their own hands, the militant faction may only have more powerful targets. Yeah, don't fight back or the fascists might kill more of you.
That's right.
Meanwhile, Aymeric, us, and the rest of the Scions will lead the assault on the vault itself. Thancred is stoked to get back to clobbering. Artuariel wants to join the battle as well. We meet outside a side gate. Aymeric's plan is to sneak silently in and focus on freeing the hostages.
Fucking Artuariel out here with the hugest dunk of all time on Horseshoefout when he goes, my shield will not break. Amazing. Get his ass.
Oh my god. We don't know how many true brothers there are inside or how heavily armed they are. One of them claims to have served directly under Thordon the Seventh, and their martial prowess suggests that might be true of even more of them. They may even know how to turn the vault's own defenses against us. And then we start a solo duty.
Yep. And it feels extremely long because the vault is too big. Mm-hmm. We sneak inside the darkened vault and begin running from point to point on the first floor, killing reactionary terrorists and unshackling their hostages. One of the true brothers sounds the alarm, and Sir Simeonard, which is the worst name I've ever heard, one of Thordrin's most fervent lapdogs, is behind the hostage crisis and is waiting for us on the platform where we fought the vault's first boss. When we approach Sir Simeonard, Aymeric gives his word that if he surrenders and releases the hostages, they will be shown mercy. Simeonard scoffs at this and calls Aymeric a heretic and a kinslayer before giving the order to activate the Clockwork Knights and to have them start harming the captives. Claims that unlike Aymeric, he is a man of honor. Extremely good two senses back to back. He draws his blade to attempt to render his judgment. Aymeric feels comfortable facing this trial by combat alone and commands us to save the hostages. We run back down the stairs and take out two sets of knights and their priest companions, which this makes me very annoyed how this works, while they're wailing on the defenseless Broom citizens they have captured. While we're unshackling the hostages, we can see that Aymeric's health is draining. If we don't finish the rescue operation quickly, he will surely succumb to Simeonard. We free the final hostage and rejoin Aymeric to finish the fight. The reason this sucks is that these are unmarked and take place outside of the map.
Yeah, and none of the knights themselves are much danger, but you see Aymeric's health ticking down, and you're like, where the fuck are these things to fight? And you cannot rely on the map. You have to look in the margins for purple named enemies.
Here's what sucks the most is that when you go from where the meeting with Simeonard happens towards the entrance, the way you were going, they're all behind you. When you turn a corner, they're behind you. So you just if you're not just spinning the camera around the whole time, you go all the way back to the entrance and then run all the way back, and it takes forever.
Yeah. And I would have hated to have to repeat this solo duty because I just couldn't find the enemies. It's like, well, nothing individually was a challenge, but I just like didn't find the unmarked shit in time. So got to do the whole thing over again. Thankfully, that didn't happen, but it came close. It was Aymeric was probably down to like 20% health when I rejoined him.
Luckily, they were having a Dragon Ball Z fight where there can only be two combatants at a time, no matter how many people are on each side.
Yeah. With Simeonard defeated, the captives we have saved frantically inform us that a high priest took a girl named Maylee upstairs. We all hurry up to the upper levels to try to save her. We see a high priest in spectacles as he is holding a young girl by the throat over a ledge on the upper floors. We rush towards him, but he threatens us not to come any closer. Aymeric tells him we have him surrounded and commands him to surrender. The priest spits back that he will not surrender to the blasphemer who throws Ishgard's gates open to the enemy and calls them brother. He would rather die than surrender to an ungodly swine. Aymeric bellows, "Is it godly to spill the blood of an innocent child or to burn the homes of your brothers?" The priest responds that Thordin's blood and this child's blood are both on Aymeric's hands, not his. He casts his gaze towards the terrified girl, and a cruel and crazed grin opens up across his face. He shoves her forward and lets go. The girl screams and hurtles towards the earth. On the ground, the crowd watches helplessly in horror, some covering their eyes as they expect a violent landing. A draconian shadow swoops across the sky, and Vidofnir appears, saving the girl from certain death. The two land, and the girl runs behind Lucia and hides from her dragon savior.
Vidofnir greets Lucia and asks if she came at an awkward time. Lucia says, "Actually, it's our fault for providing such a bad welcome." Maylee thanks the dragon for saving her, though she is still cowering behind Lucia's legs. Aymeric arrives from upstairs and says that he is surprised but grateful to be in Vidofnir's debt. Vidofnir brings her great head down to our level, calls us friend of Ysail and warrior of warriors. She bears a message from Hraesvelgr. Nidhogg Shade did sing to his children who have taken flight for skies unknown. Vidofnir and Hraesvelgr wanted us to know since our fate is inextricably bound to Nidhogg's. Alphanod asks if Astinian is truly lost to us, but Vidofnir does not know. She only wanted to pass the message along. She bids us farewell and takes flight.
Count Edmont remarks that a dragon swooping in and saving an innocent child will be remembered by the Ishgardians who witnessed it. He hopes that it will bring man and dragon closer together and not just further drive a wedge between Ishgardians on opposite sides of the issue. After 1,000 years, the world that these men knew is changing quickly, and Edmont warns that the reactionary's cause might gain new supporters. He shares Aymeric's desire for peace, but he will not see it built on the bones of his countrymen. Edmont tells Aymeric that he sees a lot of Horshafon in him and that he cannot bear to lose another son. Aymeric is very, like, touched by this. Alphanod prays that the Ishgardian centrists will take these events and accept the truth of Aymeric's words.
Ishtola asks us to hang back while Alphanod and Thancred go talk to Tataru. She asks us if Thancred seems quite well. When we respond that he held his own in the vault, she clarifies that his etheric flow looks irreparably disrupted. She worries that he may no longer be able to wield magic. That might explain why he chose to remain in the wilderness, didn't teleport, and waited on Ravana instead of felling him himself. She asks us to keep her theory quiet until she has proof and goes off to rejoin Kryl and Matoya, worried that Kryl's goodwill with her old teacher may run out soon. The remaining Fortomps children meet us inside their manor. They present us with a shield bearing the official House Fortomps crest as an overdue expression of gratitude.
Artuariel informs us that Edmont plans to step down as head of house soon. Some Ishgardians believe he was also complicit in the coup, and he wants to renounce his title to protect his house from suspicion. Artuariel has tried to convince his father otherwise. The pride he used to feel at succeeding his father as head of household has been replaced with dread. His house's legacy is built upon the lies of their forefathers, and he worries that if he becomes the next count, he would only be perpetuating this injustice.
Yeah, but also, imagine if it was a Manelaine instead.
Oh my god. Just immediately gets the house dissolved. We tell him that a knight lives to serve. Artuariel smiles wryly and imagines that Horshafant would tell him to accept the position in order to aid those in need. He hopes that when we look at our shield, we remember Horshafant's words. He asks us to show him the way if his resolve ever wavers, and to treat him like a brother the way that we treated Horshafant like a brother. We get one last Count Edmonk memoir quote this episode. He says, "Those were the days of promises and vows, of tentative first steps into an uncertain future, a future shaped by the choices we made in ways we could have never foreseen, born of good and evil, of light and darkness, and shepherded by our hand, be it for weal or be it for woe."
The camera cuts to Yuriangez being shown a book by Elidibus and the Warriors of Darkness. Elidibus is saying something about the fates of all people being ordained long ago. The warrior senses someone watching them, but when he looks, there is no one there. Finally, we see Papalimo and Yida in a cave. They appear to be coordinating an ambush on the Garleans with a group called the Masks. Papalimo fears it will be bloody, and Yida, who's cleavage the camera decides to stare at in this scene, hopes it will be. Papalimo tells his ally that they can't stay here forever, and Yida responds that she intends to fulfill all of her responsibilities. And that's the end of the content for this episode. What did you think about it?
You know, it... This is... I really like the what now. It's like, okay, we killed God. Now we have to, like, rebuild society around it. Like, I love when games do that, when games deal with the aftermath, with what comes next. It's why I love Final Fantasy X-2 so much. I'm frustrated by the ideology of this game, as always. But, like... You know, it's good to see Thancred again, even though he's not Thancred yet. It's nice to see that, like, the people who are still trying to sow discord are the upper class reactionaries. Like, all that stuff is cool. I'm glad that there are fewer quests in this patch cycle, but yeah, wow, these last few were so long, and I was very annoyed by the solo duty, so that's how I feel.
The ideological problem is that this is inherently a reformist revolution, right? Like, it'd be like, yeah, if when the libs eventually do a revolution to eliminate the Electoral College, and that's it. That's the scope of their aims.
100%.
Everything else, good, except for the solo duty map complaints, which are fairly minor. This is good stuff. I think you'll get more of what you're looking for out of the Stormblood patch cycle.
Yeah. 100%. I am very excited for the Stormblood patch cycle, even though we might be there for like a year and a half.
Uh-huh. They're so long. Uh-huh. I love that building a community really amounts to donating some, here's some ore I found. They're doing their best.
They are.
Peace out, fuckers.
Bye.
Thanks for being a patron. Your continued patronage helps us to make the shows that we all love without it becoming a financial burden or having to put ads in them. In case you didn't know, we have other shows that you might enjoy, such as Being Mr. Boot, Lightning Strikes Thrice, Being Jim Davis, and last but not least, Boku No Stop. You can help us out further by rating and reviewing your favorite show on iTunes and telling a friend about our podcast. Thanks for being a loyal patron. We'll see you next time.